Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Smith, Judge Flory, the Honorable Lucinda Jessen presiding. Before the court is case A20-1404 in the matter of the welfare of the child of TAVG parent.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is April 8th, 2021. And this is the second of two oral arguments we have this morning. As you would in our courtroom, each of you will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask each of you to introduce yourself when you begin each argument, because these arguments are being recorded, and that way we'll be clear who is talking when. With that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Thompson. I represent the appellant, TAVG, in this matter. This is a ICWA termination of parental rights that the questions before the court are whether ICWA was applied properly, whether the testimony of the qualified expert witness was sufficient to make the heightened determinations required, and whether the factual basis met the requirements for active efforts being made to reunify parent and child here. First, it's appellant's argument that the qualified expert witness, while she was certainly an expert in her field and qualified as far as the position, she did not have sufficient knowledge of the case to make a fair statement that reunification would result in serious emotional damage to the child. The district court's finding that the testimony was sufficient does not comport with the facts as stated in the record.
Well, Ms. Thompson, if I may ask you about that. I mean,
certainly.
Isn't that argument go to, I mean, traditionally, if we weren't in an ICWA case, that sort of argument say, look, she didn't have the foundational reliability, she should not have been an expert. Yet, as I read our law, it says the tribe gets to decide who is the expert witness in this case, not the district court. So help me understand how that's not the case here.
Well, as I said, as an expert, she certainly is an expert as far as the subject matter as a general topic, but particular to this case, she says herself, She confused the gender of the child. She had the facts incorrect about the timing of some of the domestic violence in the relationship. She was going off of misstated facts from the social worker. So she said in her own testimony, I guess I can't really say whether or not this would result in emotional trauma. So
counsel, may I follow up? Is your argument that this expert's testimony should not have been admitted, or that it was not weighed appropriately by the district court?
It's that it was not weighed appropriately. I think it it's distinct from a credibility determination, because while we do default to the district court's credibility determination, the very concrete facts and information she gave do not support the finding that the district court made. So she stated herself that she didn't know the case, she didn't know the family, but the court found she did. She said she couldn't make that determination of serious emotional damage, but the court found she did. So it's not that, it's not credibility, it's that the facts were weighed improperly, and the facts led to the findings, led to the conclusions, led to the termination. So the very root of it was her testimony, which she herself said was not sufficient.
Could I ask you, counsel, about the best interests argument that you're making?
Certainly.
I'm not exactly sure I understand your, what specifically are you making an argument that the district court applied the wrong law, misapplied ICWA with respect to best interests, or again, is it that the evidence was insufficient to support the determination of what the best interests are?
It's that the evidence was insufficient. It's from the social worker's statements about, she made the statement that the appellant was using methamphetamine, the abbreviation, it was methadone that he had been drugged with. She made misstatements about timelines. So all of the factual basis, again, was admittedly in the record inaccurate. So the best interests of the child couldn't properly be found based on inaccurate information. So it's not that the law was applied improperly. It's that there was not a basis, not a factual basis. So the standard of review is abuse of discretion. So, and I think that is appropriate when we're looking at facts and findings that don't match.
Did the district court, though, the district court, what findings in particular then are not supported by the evidence? I mean, it seems like the district court recognized, I think, some of the issues that you are talking about. I don't know that the district court was misled as to the evidence with respect to, you know, the refusal to test and the presence of methadone, I think, et cetera. And also even the experts, you know, the limitations on the expert witnesses' testimony. So what is it, what findings in particular are not supported by the evidence that's here, in light of the fact that it seems like the district court recognized what you are saying, what some of your complaints are today?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that's especially troubling that the district court recognized that the information just wasn't there yet. Pardon me, I'm grabbing the district court's decision.
Court recognized that the evidence wasn't there, but it recognized some of the issues. For example, it said, recognizing, for example, what the expert, the sort of the shortcomings of the expert's information, still found the testimony helpful.
Right. I do think, though, that acknowledging that the limitations were there, it was almost as if the district court acknowledged them, but overlooked them in making the findings. If I can look specifically at the decision. Specifically, the conditions that led to the child's out-of-home placement. There was a misstatement of fact that there was domestic violence in the relationship that led to the child's out-of-home placement. Domestic violence occurred in the relationship after the child was placed out of the home. The social worker, the court, the qualified expert witness were all hinging their decisions and opinions on the idea that there was domestic violence in the presence of the child, which was—
Ms. Thompson, if I may, the district court, as I recall, said that that was, acknowledged that, but said it was immaterial. So could you just be real specifically, tell us how you think that was material?
Certainly, it was part of the case plan that that appellant attend domestic violence programming. He was censured essentially for not attending domestic violence programming. So it became a part of the active efforts to reunify that was inappropriate in the beginning because it wasn't a facet of the relationship.
Ms. Thompson, if domestic violence happened, whether it happened before or after the child was removed, wouldn't it be important for him to go through these domestic violence classes?
It is insofar as the relationship between the parents certainly is its effect on the child. It's not a statutory basis that they're— if there's domestic violence in a relationship, if it doesn't affect the child, it's not relevant to the child protection matter. There are several instances where there's domestic violence in a relationship, but it doesn't happen in front of the child. And social workers generally don't. They will recommend domestic violence programming for the health of the family and the couple, but not hinge reunification or trial home visit, et cetera, on that. And that's what happened here. There was not a reunification or any serious attempts at it until he complied with a facet of the case plan that didn't affect the child. also the finding of that active efforts were made. As I mentioned in my brief, the child was moved a great distance from appellant's home. The prior trial had found the agency had not made active efforts with regard to the appellant. In the facts show that the distance made it nearly impossible for the appellant to comply with the case plan. The travel, if I can just go, I'm sorry, I'm switching screens here. He was given a certain set of goals that he simply could not achieve with the child being located where she was. The parenting skills classes, the number of visits that they were to have together, the finding employment near his home, participating in therapy, random drug tests, all those things, because there was 6 hours on the road round trip to be with the child. It precluded.
Why do all those things, I'm sorry, counsel, to interrupt, but why do all those things require that he go to Langdon for classes, for drug testing, et cetera? I mean, the child was in Langdon, but he was in,
right.
He was not.
Right. Right. It's my point is that while he's driving 6 hours, if he's called for a random drug test when he's 3 hours away, there's no way he can achieve that. If he's spending that much time on the road, there were no overnight visits, no weekend visits. This was all during the week, but he was tasked with finding employment and keeping it. If he's gone 2 days of the week for the full day driving, it was basically impossible for him to do that. And then when he did find a job.
Sorry. You know the record better than I do, but my recollection was that then they moved the visits to Sunday. I mean, so there wasn't as much conflict. Am I incorrect about that?
I believe that was late in the case that the visits were moved to the weekend. And by that point, it was so far along in the case that another termination petition had been filed. It's also telling that immediately after the trial where active efforts were not found, the social worker was already planning to file another termination petition. So the focus of the agency was not reunification at this point. It was supporting their termination, which they had not been able to do in the first trial. So there was a conflict between their goal of terminating his rights and what should have been their goal at rehabilitating and reunifying with the child's
counsel. Wasn't there a significant issue in this whole matter, though, that your client pretty much categorically refused to comply with drug testing, whether it be hair follicle or other testing? And it seems that compliance with that basic requirement would have gone a long way to allowing further contact and with the child. To me, that seems like kind of a basic underpinning of what he needed to do, and he was refusing to do it according to the record.
And I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. It absolutely would have gone a long way to repair that relationship. My client's position at the time was he had never used methamphetamine. He had never used any illegal substance, and he was being asked to test for no apparent reason. That was his thinking at the time.
I agree with that. But I mean, what the court had in front of it was that when the child was placed, he was unavailable because he had overdosed on methadone. So whether he took it intentionally or it was slipped to him, it seems to me there was a basis for the court to order that he prove himself through drug testing, and he refused to do it. I mean, to me, that's kind of what started everything here, and could have been easily rectified by him.
I absolutely understand what you're saying, Your Honor, and I don't disagree. I think that it would have been in his own best interest to comply with that. I think that speaks to one of my pet peeves with child protection social services is an abuse of plenary power. If a parent doesn't comply with a case plan, regardless of what's in it, then it becomes a sort of punitive relationship. Social services wield so much power when they have a child in their possession that if a parent doesn't comply with every dot every I and cross every T, then social services starts to push away and disintegrate the relationship with the child. So in this case, yes, he should have complied with that random drug testing. I do not disagree with you. I don't think that was a sufficient reason to not provide the active efforts and bring that child to a placement that would have been much closer and more appropriate, or to start a trial home visit. I think there was plenty of reason.
Didn't ICWA require a familial placement, and it was his sister that was available?
It's his adopted sister. That's correct. But I believe that I have to apologize. I don't know the background, if there was a different placement that would have been available. But the proximity itself was not in the child's best interest to have her so far away, regardless of whether she was with family or a non-relative placement.
But like Judge Jessen said, despite his failure to drug test, the agency still arranged for visits closer to home on Sundays, and he missed many of those visits.
Again, he was between a rock and a hard place. There was one that he needed to work for, that I recall. I don't recall that he missed many of the visits, but I know there was one where he had to work.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. Ms. Stock, we will turn to you, and we can now see your video.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Katie Stock, and I represent Clay County Social Services. There are four issues before this court, mainly related to whether active efforts were made, whether the district court erred in finding the qualified expert witness's testimony credible and supported by the evidence, whether the district court erred in finding the statutory grounds were proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and whether the district court erred in finding termination of appellant's parental rights was in the child's best interest. In my review of the appellant's brief, I believe the argument was statutory interpretation, which applies a de novo standard of review. But the statutory interpretation requires a determination by the court about the meaning of the statute or what certain words or phrases mean. And I did not find that as part of the argument here. I interpreted the appellant's arguments to be a sufficiency of the evidence argument. And under that standard of review is clear error. And a finding is clearly erroneous if it is either manifestly contrary to the weight of the evidence or not reasonably supported by the evidence as a whole. I believe the district court made very detailed and specific findings addressing all of appellant's concerns in this matter, specifically related to, I'll discuss appellant's arguments first, related to the qualified expert witness.
Could I just ask, Ms. Stock, if I may, I just ask you about, because active efforts, it's a high standard ICWA sets, and for good reason. And the district court, I believe, noted this is troubling, and I find it troubling too, that what, less than a month after the court said active efforts, that standard had not been met, as I understand it, the county said to the tribe, but we're gonna kind of proceed to terminate his parental rights. That does not seem within the spirit of active efforts and actually looks to me like a red flag. Is there anything that's in the record that would provide context for why that happened or how that happened?
Yes, Your Honor, I can understand your concern. And I do agree that perhaps the way it was expressed was maybe not consistent with the correct expression behind it. I don't think it was an intentional act of Clay County Social Services that we really want to terminate this parent's parental rights. I think it was a combination of all of the factors prior to trial, including since trial, and at the time that communication happened, I believe it was over a month since trial had happened, and that there was still a lack of participation by appellant in signing releases, in consistently attending visits, in refusing drug screens, and that the behavior that happened prior to trial was still ongoing. I agree that it was perhaps in poor taste to state it the way it was, but I do not believe Clay County had ill intentions in not wanting to work active efforts or reunification with this family. With regard to the qualified expert witness.
Just to follow up. So when was the trial relative to the decision relative to the communication at issue?
The second trial in this case occurred in October of 2020, and I believe
the first trial
occurred in January of 2020, and I believe the communication between the social worker reaching out to the tribe, asking for their opinion on whether they would support a termination of parental rights petition again, happened within, I believe, 4 to 6 weeks after that January 2020 date.
Of the trial, okay, thanks.
Of the trial, yes. And like I said, at that time, there hadn't been consistent cooperation by the appellant. Related to the qualified expert witness, the weight of that witness's testimony is for the fact finder to determine. The district court made explicit findings in its findings in order that the child's associate member status had an effect on how much knowledge and participation the qualified expert witness and timing that person could give to this case. Essentially, they were prohibited from offering certain services because the associate member status, meaning this child had less percentage of Indian blood than what a regular member would qualify for. The court also cited to the distance of this tribe in Fort Peck, Montana, in comparison to Clay County, Minnesota, and that there were several hours difference, which hindered, you know, some forms of communication. And the court also cited to information that the qualified expert witness was familiar with. She knew about the domestic violence between the parents. She knew about the lack of drug testing. She knew the age of the child and her vulnerability based on her age. She knew the big picture details about this case sufficiently to be able to offer an opinion about whether the child returning to this parent's home would result in serious physical or emotional damage. And I believe the court did address all of these concerns in its order. With regard to the active efforts, I believe some of the arguments were in-home family skills was not held in Langdon, but it's important to note there were several challenges related to the child being placed in Langdon, North Dakota, and as the court indicated, under ICWA, we are required to place with a family member. This was a paternal sister we were required to place with. ICWA does not have any requirements saying you only need to place with a parent if they're within the county or within X amount of miles from where the child was removed. And so I believe Clay County correctly followed the Indian Child Welfare Act in placing the child with a paternal aunt or the appellant's sister. Admittedly, a 3-hour distance does create some challenges, and I believe Clay County made active efforts to accommodate those challenges by making referrals for in-home family skills through Langdon, North Dakota, Devil's Lake, North Dakota, Grand Forks, North Dakota, and also Moorhead.
So when if I may ask a question, and this may be just more detailed than you have at your fingertips, but after the county moved the visits to Sunday to accommodate appellant's schedule, other visits were scheduled. How many did he make? I mean, when one of the things that raises repeated failure to attend visits. So if we could think about that time frame, could you help me with that?
Sure. Do you mean from the first trial date going forward?
So as I understand it, the appellant saying 3 hours was a long time. So, and the county recognized that it was a long time, 6 hours round trip. The county moves to Sundays to, as I read the record, to avoid some of the conflicts with a job or a potential job. Okay, after that move was made, do you have a sense of how many of those visits that were scheduled for Sunday did he miss? Did he make?
I don't recall specifically if he attended any of those visits. If he did, it may have been one or two, but I don't believe very many were attended, if at all, before he requested those, or he indicated to Ms. Pike that Sunday visits would no longer work for him. I believe at that time visits were still available in Langdon, but I don't recall that for sure. I would also like to note too that we did attempt to bring the child to Morehead for visits, and there were some issues with that. I believe the court, in one of its intermediate disposition hearing orders, ordered Clay County to bring the child here for visits, monthly or bi-monthly, so long as Mr. Van Grinsven attended those visits, and that if he were to fail to appear, those visits would no longer occur in Morehead. And that the reason for that was because of transporting the child from Langdon and having her disrupt her schedule to come all the way to Morehead, and then to have a parent not show up for those visits was detrimental to the child. And so we did, in fact, after no showing, Mr. Van Grinsven failed to appear at one of those visits, we did continue to offer at least one more visit in Morehead to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I don't recall if he attended that visit or not. With regard to the domestic violence, we're not disputing that there may have been a communication related to the timing of the domestic violence incident. But the fact remains that domestic violence did occur between the parents of this child. It did occur after the child was already placed. Mr. Van Grinsven was convicted of a misdemeanor domestic assault, and he was placed on probation for that conviction. As part of his sentence for that case, he was ordered to complete domestic violence courses called Amend Group, and he was also ordered to complete that as part of his case plan. Clay County offered offered to help Mr. Van Grinsven attend those classes after the COVID-19 pandemic hit and those classes were suspended. They were started again virtually, but a Wi-Fi connection was necessary in order to attend. Clay County Social Services offered to pay for those classes at $20 per class, and then also offered the Clay County Social Services building to him to allow him to use the Wi-Fi and to give him some privacy during those classes. To my knowledge, Mr. Van Grinsven did not take advantage of those opportunities. And if I could just back up with regard to the miscommunication about the domestic violence, the court expressly found that Clay County Social Services did not intentionally make any sort of miscommunication. They acknowledged that mistakes happened and that there was a miscommunication in this situation, but that it was not done intentionally. I believe Ms. Pike testified that if she had known about this, or if it had been brought to her attention, that she would have made efforts to correct the miscommunication. In fact, the district court found that this was another example of Mr. Van Grinsven's inability to take any sort of responsibility. It was another situation where he placed blame on other people and didn't take appropriate steps to clear up that communication. And the district court expressly found that that was just another example of his inability to participate and cooperate in a case, in this case. I believe one of the arguments related to the best interest, whether termination of parental rights is in the child's best interest, relates to, was in regard to terminating the parental rights of a Native American child. And it is possible to terminate parental rights of a child who is enrolled or eligible for enrollment in a Native American tribe, but it must be in the child's best interest. And then and in determining whether it's in the child's best interest, the court looks to factors related to how this is going to affect the child and how it's going to affect the parent. The court also takes into consideration, you know, these other issues are somewhat overlapping. And the court did make explicit findings that because the parent failed to make substantial or sufficient progress on his case plan, that it would be in the child's best interest to for the parental rights to be terminated. And if there are no questions from the court, I would ask the court to affirm the district court's finding and order terminating the appellant's parental rights to the child.
Any questions from the panel? Then Ms. Thompson, we'll turn to you for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Pardon me. Essentially, the respondent's brief and argument is that because this child was an associate member of the tribe, that this is somehow ICWA light, that the active efforts that would apply to a Native parent didn't necessarily apply to a Caucasian parent. That because the expert witness didn't give her the amount of time that she would have because of her associate member status, that somehow excuses the expert witness lacking knowledge about the case. As Your Honor mentioned, the spirit of active efforts, the spirit of ICWA is a spirit of reparations, honestly. It's not only, it doesn't attach to just the whole family, it attaches to the child. So the child deserved the active efforts, not just the appellant. She deserved active efforts to stay with her birth parent.
Can I ask counsel, with respect to active efforts, what efforts were not provided that needed to be provided?
Well, there was
if
the question,
child was in Langdon and he was in Moorhead.
Right. There was the question of visits. The court had ordered that there be a visit, I believe it was weekly, in Moorhead, as long as dad didn't miss any visits. There were only 4 visits scheduled. The one visit that was missed was because he had to work. But there were, from that time frame, the court asked how many visits did he miss. There were only 4 scheduled, and he missed one of them for work. So that was maybe a reasonable effort given the distance with the child, but not an active effort to make that happen.
Explain that more. Are you saying that they should have scheduled more visits in Moorhead with the child? Is that the active efforts that is missing?
Absolutely, and they should have been scheduled from the beginning. There was also parenting skills classes. The agency found a provider that wouldn't provide them in the location of the visits. Rather than seeking out a provider who could actually do the work, they went with a standard one. So that the parenting classes didn't get started until much later in the case. The domestic violence programming was ordered 14 months after the child was removed from the home. If it was truly a concern for the family, it should have been a part of the case plan from the beginning, but it actually came out of a probationary condition. The question about the timing of the agency's statement, which Ms. Stock acknowledged was in poor taste, the order came out January 22nd from the trial that was held in January, and I believe it was in February that the statement was made that they were going to pursue termination of parental rights. I don't know that between that 4-week period would be enough, finding that efforts hadn't been made in the first place to turn around and terminate rights with a 4-week time period to comply is really insufficient and points to the agency's efforts to pursue termination rather than reunification. Ms. Stock also cited the court's finding that the appellant demonstrated an inability to cooperate. Again, cooperating with the agency's case plan is not a statutory ground for termination of parental rights. What wasn't found was a factual basis for the grounds for termination, that she was neglected and in foster care, and that he was palpably unfit. The manifest weight of the evidence is contrary to the findings made by the court. He pursued the relationship with the child, but several things were roadblocks were put in his way. So ICWA does apply to this case. It applies to this child. One thing that I was taught early on in child protection is picture a child like the rabbit in Alice with a big clock hanging around their neck. The timeline applies to the child, not the parents. And ICWA applies to this child. She deserved for the agency to do everything they could to keep her with her father, even though he wasn't the native parent. She, as a native child, associate member or full member, deserved the agency's active efforts. And I believe the facts bear out that they were not provided. Thank you.
Thank you both for your helpful arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement and a decision will be issued within the statutory time frame. And with that, that ends our oral argument for this morning. The court is in recess.